Rachel.
My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead, and I'd like to welcome you to this session. A couple housekeeping things. I just put out teaching session evaluations, which are also found in the dining hall on the east bulletin board. And these are generic for any teaching session that you attend, and we would so appreciate you filling those out. And there's a manila envelope for completed evaluations on that bulletin board. Also, there are recommendation forms for teaching faculty and guest musicians for next year and or future years, and we appreciate those recommendations too. So thank you, John.
Thank you, Senator Sharon.
John Marty from Roseville, Minnesota, and his topic this afternoon is building bridges, not walls. We found out there was a typo for a couple of days that said building brides, not walls. We found the error. And it's
building brides, not grooms,
bridges,
or something. Right?
Not walls. At least it didn't say like mail order brides.
Right, right. Anyway, different kind of topic.
So thank you, John, very much.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you. Very pleased to be here with you. And this theme very much ties in with the whole and beginning together theme. This week, John's photo exhibit, I went to one of his sessions this morning, and very much talking similar things about how we work together, how we change the direction we're going. Again, I think the metaphor of bridges and walls is not just a metaphor these days. It's actually literally what's happening in some cases, the wall portion that we're trying to say, maybe we need another approach. Start out with the thing at Holden. I think we all understand that every one of us is unique. Chris Sharon's presentation earlier talking about how white Christians are going to be a minority or are a minority in the country already. But each one of us from different religions, different cultures, races, ethnicities, we've known that. We know we're different. We know we're all unique. We're all individuals. And yet, especially at Holden, we recognize that we're all created in God's image. All people are treasured. And Roy Hammerlin, who was here last week from Concordia Moorhead, quoted a quote from Dorothy Day I never had seen before, but it very much summarizes Christ's teachings. We love God as much as we love the one we love the least. And I think that that's core. I mean, our faith in many times in the gospel, it's talking about how do you love God? But you show it in your love for your neighbor. And this is a nice summary of it. But do we remember that? I mean, we do remember that in church on Sunday morning. We remember that in certain places. Certainly remember it here at Holden Village, but do we remember it when we turn to our talk in politics and civic life about refugees, immigrants, about who's acceptable, who's not? Pictures often help. It's a little hard to see here maybe, but a bunch of cute little Syrian kids at a refugee camp. Sorry, kids, we can't take you. You might be a terrorist. I think for those of us who recognize that we're supposed to get along, somehow showing these images to others may be a helpful point. And yet, this is for those of us who see all of us are created in God's image, these are difficult times. The nationalist movements, certainly the movement in the U.S., I mean, America first, build America, make America great. Similar types of things, it's being used by political movements in most countries. In France, they were facing similar things. Obviously, Russia. It's happening across the nations of the world, the preaching of hate and division with horrendous consequences. Difficult times, the closing of borders. I think the ones in Eastern Europe where you have people walking from the train station because they're not allowed to cross the border, trying to do it. And it does end up in causing tragic deaths. We've seen too many pictures and stories of it in Mediterranean boats. We've seen it in the semi-trailers in southwestern United States where somehow people leave trailers in a hot sun and people suffocate. We see it in hate speech. This is meant in our country, hate speech against foreigners, against Muslims, against Sikhs. Most people don't even know what the Sikh faith is. They just know that people wearing turbans are foreigners and bad and Muslim. A lot of the people with the most hate don't even know the differences, or they don't know who they're hating, they just know they're different. And that makes it difficult times for us. Efforts to block Muslims from immigrating, the efforts to build the wall, all of those are the things we have to recognize. And again, it's throughout the world, the separation walls in the Palestinian territories, it's like the apartheid of South Africa of 25, 30 years ago. When we get to this stuff, I think most of us can conceive of the types of nasty things people do to each other to a certain extent. But our daughter spent a few months in India about 10 years ago working for a Catholic human rights group that was documenting Gujarat, where Modi, who is now the Prime Minister of India, a nationalist, Hindu nationalist, was in charge of the state in 2002 when there was a fire on a train that killed a number of Hindu folks, and there was horrendous riots. Several thousand people were murdered. I mean, just in brutal ways, unspeakable ways. And authorities just turned their backs and let it happen. And you see, how can people do these things? I'm not sure. I think the one thing we have to recognize that this new millennium and this terrible violence, it's not new. I mean, people who lived through World War II saw it in so many ways. People who, I mean, through Rwanda, we see these genocides happening over and over again, and you'd hope the new millennium might be different, but we see that it's not. And people using, in so many of these cases, using their religious faith, sometimes national, it's always some justification for hate and violence directed at some other people. And it's this starts with this hatred that goes into, it expands from one thing to another to another to the point where we're killing people, we're killing each other, and somehow at that point it's very difficult to stop. That's why it's so important to stop even the bad, the talk, the hateful talk, the divisiveness, and to see it happening at the highest levels in our country is scary, but again, it's not new. It's a horrendous thing we want to try and stop and so on. But this hate builds. It doesn't start with killing people. It starts with a lack of understanding, which leads to the hate-filled rhetoric, which they don't see them as children and parents, men and women, brothers and sisters. That's why that little picture of the Syrian kids matters. People connect. We had 10 years ago in Minnesota, there was an undocumented immigrant from Mexico who was homeless. I don't know what happened to his family. He was a 16, 17-year-old kid, and he was living for several months in one of the high schools in southern Twin Cities suburbs. And somehow he ducked being detected for several months, but some janitor, somebody saw him there one morning early or something and found out he was living there. And of course, the response of everybody in the community or anybody with kids in that school was, oh, we got to do something. I mean, this is a wonderful kid. Our kids care about him. They care about him because it was a person. It was not a them in the language of us versus them. That's why it's so important that we learn to get along. Forms of hatred, you know all this, the bullying, lies, ridicule, incivility, which happens in our political system more and more. Kidnapping, bombing, shooting throughout the world. Too often we respond in kind. Too often it's retaliation that we're doing. I'd argue that counterattacks, that retaliation, is a downward spiral. You do this, we're going to do that to you. You do that, we're going to do more to you. And that's how we start wars. And it happens throughout history. It continues to happen. And responding in kind, because this is how are we going to change this? Responding in kind does not change the direction. It doesn't change our opponents. Retaliatory violence kills some of the enemy. I mean, that's why when last year during some of the presidential debates, candidates were trying to outdo each other in the primary debates, the Republican primary debates, how we're going to do it. We're going to carpet bomb those communities. We're going to do stuff like which is violations of human rights laws, Geneva Convention, but trying to outdo each other and how much we hate them, how much we're going to be tough on them. And unfortunately, it creates more hatred and more enemies. You know, when we seem to forget the fact, when they do something to us, we see how hateful it is. When we do something to them, we seem to forget that bombing a community when they're collateral damage or innocent people being killed, we seem to forget that that may create 10 new terrorists for every terrorist we kill. And so it's a downward spiral that trying to stop it is the goal. How do we do it? We want to change direction. And I want to point out here, this is a thing that I think we often forget to point out to people when you're trying to persuade others about seeking a new direction. Not counterattacking does not mean passively accepting the hate. It does not mean silence. It does mean speaking out against bigotry, against discrimination, against any form of injustice, and speaking out for human dignity. Saying you're not going to counterattack, saying you're not going to respond with the same kind of lies and stuff to the other side is not a wimpy thing. Pacifism is not passivism. I think that's very important to do. There are very few things that would be more courage requiring than to a nonviolent Martin Luther King walking through Cicero, Illinois, knowing that people were throwing bricks at the people marching with him, people going after you with guns and weapons, and you're standing there taking it. That takes more courage than anything. Standing up when somebody is for a school kid, when a school kid sees somebody else bullying somebody else, to intervene. One of John's pictures in the other side was about a woman who stepped in, was doing this, being a presence in the school to make sure that kids were not doing the bullying. There's nothing that requires more courage than standing up, but somehow our society portrays it. If you want to be tough, if you've got courage, if you're gutsy, you're going to carry a assault weapon, you're going to be tougher. You're tougher than the other side because you've got bigger weapons. And somehow we have to recognize that when we're saying the other side, we have to make sure people understand that the most courageous people throughout history are the ones who stood up, the ones who did not respond with weapons, with violence, but the ones who responded with a peaceful voice. As our leaders are building walls, again, bringing people together, how do we become bridge builders? What do we do? First of all, and this is a point I think we got to say many times, we cannot change our opponents. Saying, you guys are wrong in politics, I can say as many times as I want, I think the President of the United States is wrong, hateful, everything else. That doesn't change who he is. We can change ourselves and our approach, which is the thing I think we have to focus on. If you want to be a bridge builder, you focus on how not to respond in kind. And I'm not just talking about physical violence. I'm not just talking about hateful things. I'm talking about in politics. One side does negative campaign attacks. They're clearly dishonest. Other side, how they do it? Well, they're doing it. We can't tie our hands behind our back. We got to do the same thing. And if you do that, again, it's the downward spiral, which our political system has done. Can't change the last results, the last election. This was a New Yorker cartoon from last year. Two parents, if you can't see it, two parents talking about their kids. You're the one who said, let them watch the debates. It'll be educational. Kids saying to each other, you're a big fat liar. No, you're a big. Robert Putnam line about how everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten is true, but we always want our kids to look up to role models, and I think in our civic life, not just our political life, but all of our civic life, so many of the people you want kids to look up to, you could be, I mean, I've spoken so many groups, little kids, ask women, how many, ask little girls, how many women have been president of the United States? Now, who thinks that's okay? Nobody thinks that's okay. Who wants to be president of the United States? You want the kids to all raise their hand and they're excited about this. When they're looking at what's going on now, it's kind of, their parents are telling them everything that they're hearing from that kind of level is wrong. How do we train that? You can't change, I cannot change the reality as much as I think it's offensive, as much as I think it's wrong that Donald Trump is president, nor can I change what he says or believes. This is something, I don't know, some of you may have seen this on the internet, but it's the little golden book of alternative facts. A chair is labeled a table, a dog is labeled a cat, kids are labeled pancakes, my favorite. It looks very much like those little golden books from the 1950s and 60s. The only thing that might tip you off is something new other than the theme of it is the carrot is Mnuchin after Stephen Mnuchin, the secretary of... anyway, but and I don't mean in this slide, and this is not about what the president's about and so on, but it's not just the lack of truth. It's the lack of civility. It's the hate, the divisiveness. The good news, I'd say, about my... When I try and look for good news about some of the hateful things the president says, about women, about gays, about people with disabilities, about political opponents, about everybody else, is first of all, describing what it is. He's a man who says he loves America, but from his words, it's pretty clear he dislikes or hates about 98% of the people in the country. And there was a... I've got my point I was going to make. I know. The thing that gave me some hope that our country has not gone off its rocker and this sort of thing happens was, I mean, it's kind of an ironic thing to say, but the women's marches the day or the week after the inauguration of the president, I was afraid they were going to even go to them, and there are huge crowds. Minnesota had about 10 times the number of people that were projected. And I was expecting, oh, this is wrong, and this is bad, this is going on, and all the stuff that's legitimately people could complain about. But it was very positive, upbeat kind of a spirit. And the thing I wanted to say, not only were those things inspiring because it was a positive vision about a new direction instead of saying what's wrong and grumbling and we're going to grumble for the next how many years, instead of that it was a positive tone, but one of the things that gave me some real heart was there were about 10 or 12 or 15 male, maybe media figures in some cases, but at least some of them were politicians who said really offensive things, Donald Trump-like things, about the women organizing some of those marches the day after, the women's marches. Really offensive things. And two or three of them were actually driven out of office for saying those really offensive things. And the reason I say that gives, in a really bizarre way, it gives you some hope, because you kind of get the sense if the President of the United States says this stuff, anybody, any politician, anybody can say that stuff and get away with it. But obviously, other politicians who were saying really offensive things about women or others have actually been, in a few cases, where a state senator in Nebraska, I believe, some city council members in some other cities, were actually forced out of office because of some of the offensive things they said. It may not have been the only thing, but they said that that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back on some politicians who were having troubles. It's a hard thing to say that somebody saying something offensive and getting driven from office gives you hope, but it gives you hope that just because one public official, albeit the highest office in the land, just because one public official can say really offensive things does not mean that everybody finds it acceptable for politicians and others to say really offensive things. And it may be a strange way to say that that's something that gives you some hope, but it does give you hope that the whole country has not just said whatever you want to say, whatever, there are no ground rules you can say or be as offensive as you want. But that back to the whole theme of here, you can't change who your opponent, your enemy, your, I don't use enemy in political terms here, but your enemy around the world, you can't change who they are. But in this case, when he incites hatred and appeals to fear, attacking him or his supporters as ignorant bigots or deplorables accomplishes nothing. When Hillary Clinton used the line that used the word deplorables, he may have said 10,000 offensive things in the campaign. She used one line that was clearly offensive, and I think she recognized it afterwards and so on. But the point is, every one of us has that in us where somebody who's, this guy's a racist bigot. I mean, people say those things about it, and we're going to feel that way. We're human. That's part of who we are. But it's not a good way to move forward. It's not the way you start changing direction, is to attack, attack, attack. It does not accomplish anything. So if we want to end the politics of fear and begin dividing uniting people, it requires a radically different approach. And again, to restate what I just said, we can't change what our opponents or our enemies believe or do, only who we are and what we do. And as part of that, who do we blame? I think every time you look at things, people who are hardcore Democrats blame Republicans, hardcore Republicans blame Democrats. We blame people of different races, different whatever. We're always blaming them for what's going wrong when we might ourselves be contributing to it as well. And I think that's an important part before you get into how you change things. To change it, to build a better world, to say we're in this downward spiral of hate, whether in terms of military stuff, the world is more on edge militarily than it's been in a long time. I haven't seen that nuclear clock. Remember, they used to have a thing, how many seconds before midnight we are in terms of the world blowing itself up with nuclear weapons. After the Cold War, that slipped way back, I have a feeling. Fear of what we could do to each other is rising again. But if you want to change it, the first thing you do is you start envisioning and proposing a better future. You don't keep saying, no, this is bad. You don't campaign in politics. Don't campaign against, we're not as bad as the other side, which is largely what I think I seem to hear in a lot of political races these days. But you begin with proposing a better world. Envision that better society and use our resources not to attack, but to articulate what it means and how we get there. The other day, I did a talk on healthcare, and the biggest objection, the biggest problem I see in changing and getting what I'd like to see, a universal healthcare system, the biggest problem isn't my political opponents, it's political allies and others who, well, we can't really get there, you know. You got to understand the times we're in. You can't possibly get there. And I'm saying if you don't ever spell out what you're for, if you don't figure out, here's the roadmap, here's how we want to try and get there, you aren't going to get there. You have to start with the vision on what you want to build. Again, in campaigns, don't respond with the cheap, unfair attacks. Don't campaign against the opponent. Campaign for your ideas and ideals. In politics, I'm in Minnesota, Democratic Farmer Labor Party, the Democratic Party of Minnesota. I see both parties running really vicious, unfair, grossly unfair, dishonest attack ads on the other side. And I tried to get my own political party to stop doing it several years ago, tried to come up with them, and I asked the time, this is probably 10 years ago, I asked the party's executive director, well, why you seem to think anything goes. Well, we have to run attack stuff, they do it. And I said, well, do you have any standards? Or is it anything goes? Oh, no, we've got standards. Could I see them? Oh, well, they're not written down. Well, could you tell me, since you're the one who knows their standards, you know what they are, could you tell me what they are? And I went with a person who I was trying to work with on it and asked him to list them, and he was saying, well, we're not going to do personal attacks. I'm not sure I would agree that that's what they were doing, but he listed a handful of things. We'll be honest, we'll be whatever, we'll document everything. The documentation usually means it's dishonest these days in political ads, but they had a list of things, and I wrote them all down and I sent them back to him. Is this what our standards are? Because I wanted to, if I'm going to try and convince the party leadership that they got to change it, first you got to articulate what they are. And he added one or two more and so on, but we tried to change it. But basically, well, we'll put together a study group because, you know, we can't just tie our hands behind our back. We have to do that. Uh-huh. And if you think about it, what kind of a world does it get you to if your response is, they can do it, so we can do it too? That's kind of the thing that 10-year-old kids who don't understand how to make things move forward run. It's a building up, it's attack, 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 which you got to confess is happening at every level of politics in our country. But you got to stop it somewhere. You can't change it by saying, well, we've got to do it. And of course, once we take power, then we won't need to do it anymore. We'll stop doing it. Well, no, you can't get out of the trap here. More money, more money, more money. The other side has more money, so we got to raise more money. well, what do we have to do? We have to please certain donors to raise more money. But the arms race of money, the arms race of negative attacks. In terms of this last one about campaigning for your ideas, which is the point of this, campaigning what you're for, spelling out what you and what we and what our congregations, what our communities want, spelling out that instead of the negative, I don't disagree that negative ads work. I told my party I thought they work better for the other side, because when you run these negative ads that smear everybody around, people think, ah, bunch of mudslinging, dirty politics. They don't want to have anything to do with it. And to the public, politics and governance is sort of one and the same. And one political party says, we want less government. Let's get less government. Let's get government out of the way. So when they run negative attack ads, if the ad's effective, meaning it hurts the other candidate more than it hurts their own candidate, it's seen as a positive. But even the negative underlying thing is it teaches the message, government and politics are bad, let's get rid of it. The less, the better. Say to telling my party folks that we say we believe government can play an important role in society, and here we're running ads that the underlying message is politics is dirty, stay away from it, get out of this, we don't want government, we don't want, whose message is that? But I did not have much luck with that. But it's really a bizarre thing. You know, we should demand, in other words, it's demanding your own allies, your own party, your own team change the way they do things, because saying we're somehow better than them, but or we're not as bad as them, as I guess the approach most would have, but that's not a positive message, and it doesn't work in politics. Demonstrate through our attitude and our actions what we believe. When somebody's talking about their Christian faith, how do you teach somebody else what you think Christian faith is about? By your life, by the way you live, by the way you treat other human beings. And that's true in the way we interact with other nations, the way we interact with other political parties, with the way we interact with everyone. And when we do so, there are plenty of people, when I talked to you the other day about universal health care, I think there are a lot of people at Hold, and I think any audience I could speak to in Minnesota or elsewhere, Republican or Democratic or non-politically involved or not, people want to have that happen. They want the better future. They really do care about others. It's not like everybody's purely greedy. We have generous instincts. We care about others. We want the better world. Somebody articulates a vision for getting there, and people are hungry for it. Sometimes there's a lot of political rhetoric that's not meaningful, that may be counterproductive and so on, or that may not be real to the person proposing. They want this, but not really. But a positive vision and the steps on how you get there, there is a chance to inspire people. There is a chance to say, we really can do this. When we talked the other day about universal health care, you've got a group of people here in Washington saying, we want to make this happen. How can we do it? We want to do it. When you talk about that, when you have leadership spell out that kind of vision, people get inspired. And since we're talking here about how you deal with division and so on, I think about the only way you persuade the other side, the people who have been accepting the rhetoric, accepting the scenario about how we got to be afraid of these folks, we got to be chasing them away, we got to be keeping them out, we got to build walls, we got to do this. The folks who are buying that, if we just say, well, no, we don't like walls or we don't whatever, but what are we for? Well, we don't like you guys. That doesn't build anything. But not only do you inspire people who share your values, share your goals, but you actually give an alternative that people can turn to. I think if I look at agriculture issues in Minnesota, 40, 50 years ago, the agriculture community was very strongly in party of, in my political party. The party is called Democratic Farm or Labor Party. Over the last 40 years, it's gone totally the other way, overwhelmingly to the other party, because agribusiness and others say, here's the way you farm, here's the way you do it. Any of these regulations are harmful. Any of this is bad. And what have we done? Well, we don't like regulations either, and we don't this, and we're not as bad as them. There's no vision there. It's no alternative way of looking at how you produce food, how you succeed economically. If you don't spell out an alternative, you have no chance to persuade the other side. So I would say you're not only spelling it out when you spell out direction that you want to see things move, it's to inspire your own side, your own team, your own party, your own country, but also to provide an alternative to the rest of the world or the other party or whatever. So I want to take a few minutes here to have us think about this, to discuss what can we as individuals, what can our congregation, our political allies do about this? Spend a few minutes where we throw out ideas on what that vision might be and how we show that the way we act can overcome hate. And related to that, can we envision those ideas breaking down walls? Something that, I mean, I'll just use the example because I've been talking about a lot, the healthcare thing. When I'm looking at universal healthcare, who supports that? I mean, you got a few of your party people in the metro area who support that, but I mean, overwhelmingly, how are you going to do it? I actually think there are a lot of people in the other political party who would do it. I put out a book, which I'll put a plug for. I do not make money on the books. The profits will go to the bookstore. But if you want to read it on healing healthcare, the reason I'm mentioning it now is it's a blue-covered book, and it's the subtitle. It's Healing Healthcare, the Case for a Common Sense Universal Healthcare System. My son, who teaches... does some teaching at University of North Carolina in Wilmington, very conservative community, says he's got lots of faculty folks. He's master's degree teaching undergraduates and so on. He's not faculty, but he's got some folks on the faculty who he thinks are very caring people. He says most of them are very conservative and Republicans. He thinks they'd probably like a lot of the ideas in the book, but it's not written in a way that he thinks would appeal to them. And I decided, based on that, I thought, I'm going to write the same book with a red cover, Healing Healthcare, and adding one word, the conservative case for a universal common sense healthcare system. And thinking about how, and I start the book, instead of the things I say, if you read it here, you'll see, you can read the book online, it's free as well. And I'll give you a link to that. But instead of what I started the other book with, I'm starting with the thing, and I'm not saying this guy is a Republican, but a businessman. Warren Buffett told Berkshire Hathaway shareholders at their annual meeting a couple months ago, he said, business leaders are always complaining about corporate taxes, about 2% of the economy. He says, they hardly say a word about healthcare, and healthcare he described as the tapeworm of our economic competitiveness. He says it went from 5% of our gross domestic product 50 years ago to 17% now. It's soon going to top 20%. It's 1/6 of our economy now. One of every $6 is healthcare. It's going to be 1 out of 5. Other countries have more like 1 in 10. And we can't compete with that. He says it's the tapeworm on our economic competitiveness. And what I'm going to do is try and say, I don't want to say different things to different people because where you're being two-faced or anything, but I'm very clearly saying that's why I'm keeping roughly the same book, the same cover, but trying to respond to the concerns, the questions, the whatever that I hear from Republicans, from business folks, from conservatives, and saying, you know, I think you'd get benefit out of reading the blue book too. And I don't mind you reading both and comparing them because it's the same point. But it's worded in a different way. And my point is, I really think something that, oh, this is too radical. President Obama couldn't support universal health care because it would never pass. We have to do this other thing which becomes highly unpopular and doesn't solve the problem. I argue that if you push something that makes sense, you're going to convince some people. Some people who are political elected officials who got elected with support from certain interests and so on may not switch, but the public at large, the voters who were buying this kind of what I call snake oil from certain candidates, you have a chance to persuade them if you do. So what I wanted to do is ask, as we discuss this, can you see any of the ideas that we talk about as ones that might break down the walls and bring people from other perspectives in? So I just would like it for just 10 minutes, 5 minutes to throw out ideas or whatever. Can somebody, anybody have some ideas to start with?
Can you go back to that slide that prompted us?
I'm going to turn this down from or move it. I'm having trouble hearing a little bit, so go ahead.
Can you go back to the, wasn't there a slide that was a prompt for us?
Yeah, there. Wait, this one?
Yeah.
That's the one. I wanted to know, in other words, not just, what vision, what do you have? Talking about environment or something, it doesn't have to be an issue. It can be what actions we can do, how we interconnect with our neighbors. When you're dealing with something like racism, when you're dealing with something in local school or one town in western Minnesota, they had some really bad things happening to Muslim folks, and the community stepped up and they formed a whole campaign to try and show that they're an open community and that that's not who they're about. And I think, I'm looking for any kind of ideas you have on that, whether it's on issues or actions or things, whether they're individual or congregation or neighbors or whatever. Yes?
Well, there's a lot going on that is trying to polarize us. So I think one of the ways that we can kind of remember that we're all unified as Americans is sharing stories. So finding common ground, whether it's, raising your kids or, an issue that you face, healthcare or another, but sharing actual stories person to person and trying to build cohesion and unity rather than succumb to the division that we're being tempted to embrace.
Right. Everyone could hear that okay? The idea of stories, because, we're humans. We relate to stories. We tell stories about people. That kid I was saying who was hiding in the, living in the school, nobody wanted him deported. They because he was a human being. He was a friend of their kids. He was a nice kid. They care about him. So stories, sharing stories is a good way to do it in terms of attitude, not negative things, but what we could do together. Other thoughts?
I think we talked a lot about after this last election about the bubbles that we're all in and just intentionally talking to people outside your bubble, because I saw within my own closest group of friends last summer, and five of us are together, and one is very conservative, and one just physically left, said, I can't even be in the same room with her, I can't talk to her, I've lost all respect, and it just really made me think about, if friends can't talk to friends, how can our country ever come together and, discuss these things, that we really have to listen to people outside of our own political bubble, which we haven't done, and obviously at our own peril.
How many people in here, that's really true, because we do tend to get in bubbles with people who share our ideas and our friends. How many of you feel you don't have any access to people? How can people think that way? Because I don't know anybody like that. Or how many of us, I think a lot of, I was talking to one of the staff folks here earlier today about how her beliefs, very strong, it's what she does, what she cares about, and family being a totally different world, and how interrelating and trying to work together. How many of us feel do you feel you have connections where, either at work or a neighborhood or wherever you actually spend time, have a cup of coffee with, or have a friendship group that have people who you don't share many values with, or political views or whatever? Do you feel you have that? Most of the people here feel you have some ways you can reach out to that, because I think that's a key one, finding ways to do that. So other things, and again, it can be, I think this is good, the kind of things you're saying, tell stories, you're saying connect with people, not about an issue, but just to build the friendships.
I think it's like Laura was saying, and she was saying too, and David was talking about listening this morning. I think if we can listen to people, and I was hearing this about the police violence against African Americans. If those groups could listen to each other, they could talk. For starters, it's one thing to start, because everybody's shouting, if we can hear each other, it's a starting point.
I think that's a key one. How many of us, have you seen, I know in the Twin Cities I've seen a lot of this, where church groups are, during Ramadan, Christian churches and mosques were getting together, and for breaking of the fast, for other things they were trying to connect and reaching out and having teaching sessions and so on. Have any of your congregations or communities have you been seeing similar things?
Yeah, our congregation has done a contact with a mosque, and just recently that mosque that they've had contact with got bombed.
Just a
few days ago.
And
we read on internet a message from our pastor expressing sadness about this and telling them we support them and all this. The people in the mosque.
I'm wondering how many have done it. I was out here before that thing happened, and I read in the papers of the bombing in Minnesota at a mosque. But I think I think the number of people here from Minnesota, I think the Twin Cities, I've been surprised at how many of those interfaith efforts have been happening and so on.
So, yeah, my congregation in Seattle, we're actually this coming Sunday, we're all going to be going over to the annual barbecue that the Idris Mosque holds in North Seattle. And it's an open invitation for folks in the neighborhood to come over and barbecue with them. And then we were over there in May at a potluck with them. So we've been, just sort of socializing together, talking to each other and so on. It isn't really a very formal program or anything. But then the other thing kind of related to that, we had a college professor come and give a series of classes at our congregation on Sunday mornings talking about Islam and practices and beliefs and so on. So we were educating ourselves as background like that. And then kind of the third thing is is kind of the sign campaign that we produced signs about, I can't remember if I can remember the word in here, but we support our Muslim neighbors and people who are hosting these in their businesses and homes. Again, try to
build the others.
Try to, get that word out to make it, look like it's very acceptable, to have that attitude about it instead of a real negative.
I think one of the more, I'm glad to see that. I think that's wonderful. But I think one of the more difficult things is in the political arena. I have a group of friends in Arizona when we wintered down there. And about, these are about half and half, Republicans, Democrats, and so on. But we don't talk about politics at all. And others would say that's why we're friends. But if you can't have civil conversations,
if you can only be partly friends,
yeah.
Well, it's the impolite company. You never talk politics or religion.
Yeah.
But
people get so angry about the issues,
right.
And I must say I do too. but it's somehow we have to find a way to address each other and to talk about issues and listen. So much of the emphasis this week is on listen to the other side, but also to find ways to dialogue about a lot of the issues we're talking about.
Certainly in a family gathering where these are people you have to get along with on a permanent basis or something, I understand why, let's not talk about religion or politics or certain things. But I wonder in a group like that, where it's friends and you want to get along, and you do, the idea is saying, we're not going to agree, and we can get mad, but can we decide we're going to get mad and still like each other? I wonder almost if trying to bring that kind of conversation to them, if that would work. Has anybody tried that ever? Because how many of us have had those situations where with people where let's not talk politics because it's dangerous?
Or that they won't talk to you because I think right now, at least in Western Washington, so many negative things are calling conservative people, pro-Trump people, bigots, names, you read comments online and they're awful.
And you keep thinking, that's
I find that my relatives in Arizona won't talk to me anymore. And I don't think I'm projecting anything on them, but I could be. I don't think so.
But they're hearing it from others.
They're hearing it, and I haven't talked to a sister in months because she's afraid to reach out.
John, in your area of political activity, what you're immersed in this all the time, do you have people on the other side of the aisle that you have civil conversations with about serious issues?
Very much. I think that's, I mean, I feel...
Very much or...?
Very much.
Okay.
Not with the understanding. That's one thing I think that I try and teach colleagues and others, and that is that you can disagree and disagree strongly. You don't have to be friends saying, well, we're friends, but, you know, you're nuts. I mean, you can be polite to each other and you can listen to each other. I like to think that there is no member of our legislature who I couldn't learn something from. And we all have the tendency to, that person is whatever. We have a tendency to discuss behind somebody's back negative things about them. And that's okay, we're human, we're gonna do that, but I do think it's very important, and I do try, and I think most of my Republican colleagues would say, even though I'm further away from them and from my own party and others politically on things, but nevertheless, they feel they can have a discussion, they can come to me. I've had some of them come to me on issues they know I'm 180 degrees opposite of them, but because of religious beliefs or something, they think they can confide in me what they're thinking, and ask, why would you feel this way about that? And I feel very positive about that.
Yeah,
in
good.
Other words, it's not saying we're going to be on the same team, we're going to be best friends, but I really like them. And I want them to like me and everything else. But that's why I'm almost wondering, in those settings that I think most of us have, where we have a family or something kind of gathering, and, well, we just won't talk politics. And again, you don't want to have, if somebody wants to argue politics all the time, that's not going to help. But in some of those cases, could we have a meet, if you're having coffee on a daily basis or gathering for an hour with friends in a retirement community somewhere, maybe just say, how about one day a week we talk about these things? Not an argument, but a discussion. We can be mad, but we're going to actually schedule ourselves to do that. And we're not going to yell at each other all the time, but let's see how we can discuss these. It doesn't work with some people, but a lot of people, your sister may kind of, I'm glad you were willing to tell me that you think I'm scared to talk with you or whatever, or I sense you are this, can we talk? And I mean, that's the way it goes. How about in terms of not just individuals and small groups, what about between nations? How do we build these, how do we stop the direction we're headed there? I mean, that's something we have to perhaps persuade a majority of our own folks to be interested in doing before we can get some of that. So anybody have thoughts of that, or particular issues where they think that other side might come along? I want to wrap this up quickly, but does anybody have any of those kind of thoughts? And I want to say one thing about that in a minute. But
you know, I just wanted to say, just in relation to what you were saying earlier, one of the things that I have done vocally and that has helped in terms of my interactions at church, the political issues are talked about in council, and not necessarily between membership. We're discouraged from talking politics because it is divisive and difficult. But one of the things is there's been a real emphasis on mindlessness activities, which is listening and being quiet, the things that we learned in the other session. And I understood that was being done at the Capitol.
Mindfulness and trying to get people to listen. Yeah, there are some. Unfortunately, sometimes the only people who come to those sessions are the ones who may need it the least. But it's worth doing.
It's worth doing, exactly.
And one of the things, and again, it gets to the, I'd say it's true in politics, and it's true in religion, and it's true in any place where there's division. Some people say, well, in politics, if they just all compromise more, it'd be fine. Meaning, you give up half of what you believe in, they'll give half what they believe in, and we'll all be happy. I don't think, I mean, a lot of folks here who are heavily involved in religious communities and so on, when you invite somebody of a different faith over, the goal is not to persuade them to accept your belief or yours to accept their belief, nor is it to compromise and say, well, I mean, when you try and do these civic prayers, well, we don't want to offend anybody, so we'll say something that's mushy. I mean, to me, we're better off. If I go to the family of somebody, an Islamic family, I'm fine with the idea. They pray their ways of prayer. They do that, and we learn from them, and we respect it, and we think find it beautiful. And that's a good thing to do. And in politics, the same thing. People say, well, you can't believe what you want, then you're just not willing to compromise. Well, I say one thing you got to keep in mind with compromise is if I'm trying to build a new house, figuratively speaking, if I'm trying to build a new house and my opponents are trying to burn down the house, it's pretty hard to compromise on that. Well, we'll burn down half the house and can build the other half up. I mean, at a certain point, I think the political process and all of these things and our religious differences are best if we're very upfront. Here's what we're for, and here's why we're for it. And you tell me what you're for and why you're for it, then you can have the dialogue. Then you can find out what you have in common. Last year, Bernie Sanders, who they were saying, well, if he was elected president, well, if that chance the Republicans would do anything with him, because he's more radical extreme. Well, there was an article, a couple articles out about how he actually passed more amendments on substantive policy stuff than the Speaker of the House had done several years ago when he was in the House. And why? Because he was very blunt and outspoken about what he wanted, and he was good at listening to what they wanted. You could find ways to find common ground despite those differences. And so I think there's a huge difference between trying to say, well, I'll compromise my religious views, and you compromise yours, and we can all agree on something. That's not the goal of religious beliefs. It doesn't have to be the goal of politics. But there's a huge difference between compromise and so on. We're running out of time. Articulating a vision is where we build bridges. It's by saying, here's what we're for, and spelling out how and why, not just lip service. In politics, there's plenty of, I don't know of a Democratic candidate in Minnesota who won't say they're for universal health care, who's for a clean environment, who's for better paying jobs. I don't know anybody who won't say that. What are they going to do to bring it? Well, we can't really get there. Again, I think the sincere vision and the articulation of how you do it does. Internationally, how do we work to build between nations and peoples? How do we move from, I mean, the U.S. is more, our military budget is virtually half of the world's military spending. You combine China and Russia and all the European countries and everybody else, our military budget is virtually half the world's budget. How do we move from that? Dwight Eisenhower, I think we've all seen this quote 50 years ago about the military-industrial complex. Every gun that's made, every warship launch is in a final sense a theft from those who hunger and not fed. It's a beautiful quote. Yeah. And it's the kind of thing that I think we all understand and we believe, but I think that's something that our presidential candidates, our legislative candidates or others, we don't talk that way. We don't really believe that because we know the public would never accept that because that sounds like you don't care. Well, Dwight Eisenhower, the military generals of the century, spoke out in a way and you could accept it. And you think people maybe buy some of this because they just don't hear it being said. Chris?
When I was in seminary, I found out something surprising that there were, between World War I and World War II, there was a strong movement to outlaw private manufacture of arms, mm-hmm. to take the profit motive out of the mm-hmm. manufacture and sale of arms, not only in the U.S. but internationally. Mm-hmm. And Lutheran church bodies were at the forefront of leading that, mm-hmm. which I was really moved by. And World War II just completely closed that conversation, and it's never come back. And so it just has always stuck with me that the profit motive that drives the manufacture and sale of, and the private government partnership around the sale of, you know, F-16 fighters and local communities lobbying to keep that partnership going because it keeps the plant open, which keeps the high-paying manufacturing jobs there.
Right.
Like there's a whole system there.
It's huge, and it's so huge that keep thinking President Clinton was one of those who really expanded the arms sales to other countries.
Yeah.
Obama administration, every one of our last number of presidents, both parties have expanded the sales. It's American jobs. We're arming with highly sophisticated weapons. We're arming both sides of conflict. We wonder why the world is getting to be a more dangerous place. I did not know that about Lutheran churches and that movement. Thank you. Nationally, here in the U.S., again, devote our energy to articulating the vision of a caring society. I think the single biggest thing we have to do is change how we talk, what our vision is, because we seem to be a visionless society these days. People inside us, everybody still has the same hopes and dreams in the future, but nobody talks about it. We don't talk as a society. Political parties, which is where you ought to be talking about in politics and civic life, we should be, but we don't. I thought this was one of those.
It's
clearly a phony, the Milwaukee is spelled wrong.
I'm glad to hear that.
You can get those church signs online, you can make whatever funny quote you want. But so this is a legitimate Milwaukee in Oregon.
Yes.
It's a beautiful sign.
Yes.
Forget the wall, build a deck, and invite everyone over. That's the message.
Love it.
Our vision of a caring society, that's our call. And I'll just close with this. When you have more than you need, build a longer table, not a higher fence. And I think that just is one way of helping us envision the way we want to be. And so on. Anyway, thank you very much. We can stay around for a few minutes to discuss it if there are any questions or something, but we can do this. We can build a better world, and that's what we're all here for. Thank you.